make it work. Welcome everyone to our second virtual Dearborn open mic. We are very excited to be able to bring this programming again to you this month from beyond the quarantine days. So the Arab American Center for Culture and Arts welcomes you for another night of poetry and music and culture with the Dearborn Open Mic English. So today we're going to have a wonderful program for you, starting by Professor and Dr. Hani Bawardi, who will bring us a lecture about new perspectives on the pen bond, Al-Rabit Al-Qalamiyya, who, if you have been following the events that are that have been taking place, they have just celebrated their 100-year anniversary. And tonight we'll also feature poetry from Amal Baydoun for the first time. And we will have very special live performances by Samer Sarhan and Karim Kanu. So stay tuned. We have a wonderful, wonderful program for you. And without further ado, I would love to welcome Professor Hani Bawardi, Dr. Hani Bawardi. He's a professor in history and principal faculty in Arab American Studies at University of Michigan Dearborn. And he has presented in national and international conferences. And his book, The Making of Arab Americans, changed the way most scholars look at Arab American history. And he also owns, and I can attest to that, a very extensive manuscript collection. That is very wonderful. And I know he brings a very, very, very interesting perspective on both the pen bond and the Arab history in general. So without further ado, Doctor, thank you so much for joining us, and take it away.
My pleasure. Thank you, Zena. I hope to live up to your expectations and this very kind introduction. I have a lot to share with you, to be honest with you, and I struggled as to where to start, because the more we think we know about members of Al-Rabit Al-Qalamiyya, its significance, its history, and its place in history, as frankly, is the less we know. And there are reasons for that. So I'd like to propose today to sort of talk about what is the significance of Al-Rabit. Al-Rabit Al-Qalamiyya means the pen bond, sometimes referred to as the pen league. That's not the right word. And the pen bond is slowly making its way into, you know, the discourses, which is good. Those who speak Arabic or are familiar with the heritage that came out of New York, New Jersey, seem sure of the answer, who they are and their significance. But most people either never heard of the title or are content with the impressions they have of Gibran. Gibran, or Gibran Khalil Gibran is his name in Arabic. And forgive me if I don't anglicize the names here. He is the author of The Prophet in the English language. But who were Al-Rabit members, and what accounts for their staggering importance in the Arab world? Gibran's life, writings, and intellectual capacity was certainly enhanced by his association with Amina Rehani, co-founder of Al-Rabit, originally in 1916, in fact, who was born in 1876 in Frike, in the Lebanon area of Syria. Likely with the association of Nasib Arida at the time, another author, member of this group. Al-Rabit was reformed in 1920. That was actually the official start of the this collection of authors, Society of Authors, headed by Gibran this time in 1920, and with the membership of Rashid Ayyub, Wadi' Bahout, William Katsiflis, of Greek origins, whose family immigrated to the area, we think, 300 years ago, prior, Abdul Masih Haddad and Nadra Haddad, and also the indefatigable Ali Abu Mahdi, and Mikhail Naimi, who wrote about Gibran extensively. So what's so special about these authors? Linguistically speaking, or from a purely literary point of view, That's the easy part. They share a gift of uncanny command of the Arabic letter, steeped in classical training, and they also possess the drive to innovate styles that would make Arabic language accessible to the masses. So their method was maintaining a balance of classical and more contemporary expressions and vocabulary, and writing about immediate surroundings and concerns, not in lofty grand style that characterized Arab literature for an extended period during that time, meaning from the, you know, the late Ottoman period through the start of the 19th century. So they wanted a way out of that. They wanted the people to get in touch with their history and their lives and write in Arabic about, you know, more immediate concerns. But what paved the way for their importance is the historical moment, their place in the historical moment, and convergence of several factors that are social, but also political. It's a complex topic. So at least I'd like to give you an idea about what constitutes the foundation for their importance, because they have a common theme, common thread that runs through them, which made them very, very important. And their importance actually is enduring in the Arab world. Just to be sure, I mean, I don't talk about them in abstract at all. I grew up on the poetry of Ali Abu Mahdi and all those poets, and knew their names as a child all the way in the Near East. These authors, although unique, eloquent, and possessing of superior command of the language, also thought of themselves as reformers, feminists, before the that term became salient in its, you know, contemporary context, progressive on matters of religion and human endeavors. But what did they seek reform of? What did they seek to reform if they were reformers? In fact, how much do we really know about Gibran other than he is the author of one of the best-selling books in history, The Prophet, which was also translated into over 30 languages? Who are the others? Are they as significant as Gibran? To whom did they write? All these questions are seldom discussed in the English language. The literature on them is considerable in the Arabic language. However, those guys wrote from New York and New Jersey, and their place in Arab American history is people kind of have deference for that, but they don't understand it. So how did they shape our identity in this country? And they did, by the way. That is one of the major points I'd like to make. What is their place in Arab American saga overall? I'd like to start our conversation by exploring some of these topics. Specifically, I'd like to share with you a sketch of historical, literary, and some, to some extent, political trends that yielded these important authors. The space I propose to talk about, briefly albeit, took place amid expanded European ambitions, ease of travel, and momentous events that reshaped the Near East, especially the Levant and Egypt. This isn't an exhaustive outline by any means, but my aim here is to explain the very impetus for their outlook and the major source of their inspiration. If I have to find a word that encapsulates these aspirations, it would be Syria. Not today's Syria, rather natural Syria or geographic Syria. Those folks came, many of them from parts of Syria proper, but also the Mount Lebanon area. The source of these aspirations began decades before our authors were even born. Yet they likely would have been different if they existed at all without these aspirations and historical background I propose to explain. So let me start with a few examples. So like if you go to the Arab American or the English language news in this country, you find an article about a visit by a fellow named Salim Sarkis, who was running for his life from the Sultan Abdul Hamid, the Ottoman Sultan, because he is fighting for autonomy from the Turks and ultimately independence. He came to New York in 1899, before any of our authors were even famous. So there's an article maybe my colleague Usam can find, an article about Sarkis's visit. There we go. I wonder if we can make that a little bit larger, the font. But in any case, that's an example of, you know, some of the issues that were salient at the time. The Syrians' insistence that they are distinct people who would like to be independent or more independent or autonomous from Turkish suzerainty. The man came from Egypt. There's a reason for that. Egypt was occupied by the British since 1882. Ironically, the British kept Abdul Hamid's spies and police at bay, while a lot of the Syrian migrants to Egypt found the freeway, the leeway to establish some of the most important publications in the Arab world, in Arab literary history. In Egypt, you have Syrians who founded Al-Ahram by the Thakla brothers in 1875. In Egypt also, Al-Mushir was established by the Sarkis family, not to mention Jurji Zeidan, an Orthodox Christian considered one of the fathers of modern Arab national identity. Lived there in the refuge or the safety of Egypt away from Abdul Hamid's reach, where he published Al-Hilal, and he wrote seminal books like Tariq Hikayat al-Islam, or History of Islamic Tales. It was on the pages of these publications that, in addition to Al-Muqtataf, edited by Yaqub Sarruf, another important figure, also Syrian, that Arab leadership, or the Arab readership, rather, were introduced to Gibran, Rihani, and their friends. Rihaniyat were published in Egypt, as a matter of fact. And Rihani cut his teeth on translating Ruba'iyat al-Khayyam, the quatrains of Abu'l-Ala, into English from the Arabic. And he went on to write the first novel in English, Arab-American novel in English, The Book of Khalid. But we have basic questions to contend with here. So where did these authors receive their education? That is, how and when did their philosophies on so many things emanate from? Of course, I don't mean to simplify things too much, as each was fiercely independent in their own way and commanded respect. The picture you see here is one of those, not one of our authors, but a very accomplished author who also served in the American-Spanish War, 1898, a proud soldier. And he looks like one of the Rough Riders there, very, very proud. And this picture came from a book called The Syrian Soldier in Three Wars. And in it, you can see the pictures of most of our authors. If my dear friend Wissam can pan on the other pictures of the authors, Nadra Haddad, Ali Abu Mahdi, and the rest of them. And the Three Wars, the book was published in 1919. This is not, yeah, here we go. That's the title of the book right there a minute ago. The book was published in 1919, and the Three Wars the Syrians fought in, according to the author at least, is the Spanish-American War, the war in the Philippines, and World War I. And Syrian immigrants joined the war effort and bought and sold more war bonds than any immigrant group per capita. That has to do with their, you know, preference for fighting the Turks in that war, winning their right to go back to Syria as an independent country. This is a rare book that is in my possession, complement of my dear friends, the Dalak family. The story ultimately begins with narratives, a language, the Arabic language, that in turn serves to cement common customs, traditions, and fosters collective memory of the past. Arabic is the bedrock of who we are, regardless of distance, time, religion, sect, nationality. Of late, we became members of many nationalities as of the 20th century, thanks to colonialism. color, if that even exists outside the Arabic language, and it does, perceived race or ethnicity. So, and being an Arab is to belong to a cultural identity that transcends all these things. And the Arabic language has the capacity to express that. So a good place to start would be with Nasif Al-Yazici, born in 1800. He's an author of many books during the Ottoman Empire. He's the father of Ibrahim Al-Yazici, was one of the leading figures of the Nahda movement. So here you go, a trigger word, a word that explains what motivated, what drove our authors, Nahda. Nahda in Arabic is a word which means awakening, to awaken or to get up from a slumber. So if you're sitting up, for example, you stand up, that's a different word. Yaqum is the word. Nahda signifies getting up from a very relaxed position or from a slumber, from sleep. So, and the idea was that, you know, during the Ottoman rule, long Ottoman rule, some almost 500 years, it was like akin to a deep nap, although the Ottomans sort of preserved the area from, you know, Western ambitions. But their decline was painful for the Arab population and prolonged and marked by decay and inefficiency and, you know, backwardness. So Nasif Al-Yazici is another figure in that he basically wrote on his own terms, began to conceive of himself as a member of this Arab space. Greek Catholic. And many of those guys came in contact with American, less so English, but also Franciscan priests who were there to proselytize. For example, one of those was Eli Smith. And they're the ones who established the Syrian Protestant College, which later became in 1920, was renamed the American University of Beirut. One of the finer, you know, learning institutions in the Arab world, which I wish them all the best during these difficult times right now. So he moved to Beirut in 1840, and he came in contact with these missionaries who wanted so bad to proselytize and translate the Bible into Arabic. Okay, proselytizing went only so far because most of the population were Muslims, although in the West they convinced themselves that, hey, there's like a lot of Christians that we have to sort of take care of. And for the French, that was, one of their ways of establishing foothold in the area. And the result, as you know, is confessional politics. And what came after that is French and British colonialism. But their impetus, I mean, their excuse initially was to spread the word of the Bible. So it didn't work, of course. The population were not about to convert. They already believed in God and Jesus and all the prophets, and it didn't work. But what happened is that they brought printing presses, beginning with the French in Egypt with the Napoleonic campaign in the Bulaq section of Cairo. But the Americans spearheaded that movement in the Levant, in parts of Lebanon and modern-day Lebanon and Syria. And those printing presses gave a chance for Al-Bustani and Al-Yazici, Butrus Al-Bustani, for example, and also Mikhail Mishaqqa, to establish what is called the Syrian Association for the Sciences and the Arts. It didn't last very long time, but it was a very, very important stepping stone into what became known as the Syrian Scientific Association. That association was very nationalistic in nature and sought to gain independence from the Ottomans altogether. So this became a very important part of Al-Nahda. And the leaders of this movement were themselves authors, men of letters, and women also we know less about, who basically launched a new tradition of rehabilitating the Arabic language, writing in accessible style, And our authors learned in those schools. So when they came to the States, even as children, they possessed a command of the Arabic language. And Rihani is unique in that he taught himself later on. He came as a child, I think in 1888 or so. He was born in 1876, a little bit older than Gibran, who was born in 1883, I believe. So Rihani came in 1888, learned Arabic from scratch, and became a potent author. One can talk a lot about these personalities. Butrus al-Bustani, born in 1819, also is a major Nahda figure. He is considered to be one of the first Syrian nationalists because he built on his father's work by basically, sharpening this message of being an Arab in the Levant and a member of a Syrian nation. So ultimately, they saw themselves as Arab, part of the Arab world. But their immediate goals were to establish, tell their stories on their own terms as members of this distinct group of Arabs, part of the Arab world, and members of the Levant or Syrians. He edited Al-Jinan, which basically was a variety magazine. That's a very important thing. That was actually one of those first steps into talking about sciences and literature and all kinds of things that kind of drew people together into one readership. And he came in contact with American Protestant missionaries. Those guys were accomplished in the Arabic language. And the fruits of their labor, Butrus al-Bustani working with this under the supervision of Van Dyck, and Eli Smith came up with the first Bible. Here is a copy of it. In 1866, this is the first Arabic language, not the first Arabic language Bible, but this is the first printing of the American Bible in the Arabic language. 1866. And the Bustanis went on to publish Muhit al-Muhit, or the Circumference of the Ocean, which is an Arabic to Arabic dictionary, very important one. And you would think, why would I need Arabic to Arabic dictionary? If you're a serious scholar, you do. It will be like your constant companion. And I happened to grab, this is the second part or folder two, right here. And it begins with the letter, let's see. Appropriately, Ad-Dad. Our language is also known as Lughat Ad-Dad, or the language of Dad. The Arabic language is the only one in the world that has that letter, the Dad, in it. So, Ibrahim Eliazigi, Butrus al-Bustani, Nasif Eliazigi, his father, all those people kind of charted a path for our authors. They rehabilitated or they configured the Arabic language to become everyday language, standard language, that is, not Amiya. We have our own accents from village to village, from place to place, but we are united in speaking a standard Arabic. So the poetry they came up with was a mixture of appropriate mixture of classical and modern language. They wrote in rhymed verse, but also one of them, Amina Rihani, wrote in modern verse. That's not rhymed, that is. And they were influenced by the transcendentalists, American authors like Emerson, Hawthorne, who wrote about nature extensively. So it was actually a matter of course that our authors would also write about nature and use that to kind of make the leap into social lessons of sorts. So one of those really famous poems was immortalized even further by Feruz, who sang that poem, is أعطني الناي وغني, give me the ناي or the flute and sing for me. by Gibran, which was, I think it was published first in Al-Mawakib, his book Al-Mawakib. And it has a heavy use of nature in order to deliver a very simple message using like idioms like water, trees, and the forest. And the translations is very tricky, very personal, and it's an art, and it's very complex. So I chose one from the World Association of Arab Translators and Linguists. أعطني الناية وغني وانسى ظلم الأقوياء إنما الزنبق كأس للندى للدماء. He says, give the flute and sing to me to forget the abuse of tyrants. The lily is a cup for dew, not for bloodshed. And they did this extensively. What else is unique about them? They also wrote about every part of Syria. They remembered Syria. They longed for Syria. Although they were in the United States, they acknowledged that. And they expressed their gratitude for the United States, which was not, did not have any ambitions in that region yet, as of yet. In fact, around World War I, because the U.S. kind of threw its might behind, you know, the Allies against the Turks, many people named their newborns Woodrow Wilson. For example, I interviewed one of those, actually, from the Scaff family. His name is Woodrow Wilson. So that gives you an idea. But what about Gibran? I mean, Gibran kind of disappears behind this mystical kind of shroud. He was an Arab, and he was a nationalist like the rest of them. I can go on for a long time about the poetry of Ali Abu Mahdi and how important every part of Syria was for him. And when all was lost in Palestine, or nearly all was lost, he actually wrote extensively about Palestine, as did Amin al-Rihani long before him, even before al-Nakba, which we celebrated only last week, or the catastrophe when 70% of Palestine was lost to the Zionist program. And Rihani went on to his, one of his books was actually titled Al-Nakabat, which means the catastrophes, and the real catastrophe, or the big one, happened almost 20 years after his book came out. Gibran himself was not a bystander. Ali Abu Mahdi may be best known about, you know, his uncompromising poetry about Palestine and all, as he wrote about everything else. But Gibran himself had a message for the Syrians that is worthy of remembering. So in 1911, even before World War I, by 4 years, he addressed Al-Halaqat al-Dhahabiyya, or the Golden Circles, which is a literary society in New York. And he told them, among other things, you say, what then can the Syrian do if you rob him of his hope of reformed future in the land of his birth and childhood? Does he become a naturalized citizen of the country to which he immigrated? Or does he seek help from foreign countries, throwing his weakness at the mercy of European powers? He continues, the money earned by a peddler, a solitary peddler, is money earned by all Syrians. Every word a pupil learns in the American schools is a word learned by all Syrians. Free your children from the slavery of abhorrent old Themians, traditions and old customs, and they will remain free, even in chains and jails. So this is what I meant by they were reformists. They wanted to reform Syria, make sure it's independent, and a place to go back to and start a country of their own. That drove them. Did they belong in the United States? Yes, of course they did, and they acknowledged that. In fact, and I will end with this, I know I'm taking a little bit too much time here, but, you know, around World War I, there was like a lot of racist movements, like 100% Americanism, assimilation, like the Borg in Star Trek, you know, forgetting who you are and conforming to an Anglo core. That was salient at the time. The one who challenged that first, before Horace Kahn, before anyone else, was Amina Rehani. In a book called Letters to Uncle Sam, he basically addressed Uncle Sam or the American government, and he said, I'm this downtrodden child of yours, like your stepson. Don't I belong here? And it was like a feeling analysis which basically captured the essence of cultural pluralism, the idea that you can be an Arab and yet can be a member of this country or a citizen of this country, if you will. Cultural pluralism, what became known later as hyphenated Americans, but not until after World War II. So this is a good place to end. So I hope you can at least connect the authors when you hear their names to an Arab past. And you saw the pictures that Wissam was scrolling earlier. These were sketches by Gibran. When he sketched, he loved naked bodies, but he also sketched, our heroes of the past, Ibn Sina, Al-Muqaffa, Harun al-Rashid, all those Arab, Al-Mutanabbi. This is Al-Husayn al-Awwal, the King Hussein the First, King of the Hijaz, who fought the Turks in the Great Arab Revolt in 1916. And drove the Turks out of Syria. This is Ibn Sina, his rendition of Ibn Sina, known in the West as Avicen. So they were connected to a steep, rich heritage. And they saw themselves culturally as part of this space where Arabism predates Islam, but that Islam subsumed the Arabs of the region. But they remained Arabs, regardless of religions and sectarian affiliations. Thank you.
Dr. Bawardi, as usual, Anjad, like they say, لا يمل, you are such a huge wealth of knowledge, like the all the knowledge you have, all the history, like the context, and of course, all like the beautiful, beautiful artifacts that I have seen firsthand and the wonderful books that you have. It's such a wealth. And like just speaking to you, Anjad, like la yumal, as they say, it's so wonderful to always hear you talk about these things. Because
I feel the same way speaking to you and to Michael, of course. Thank you.
Yes. So I'd like to remind everyone who's watching us that you can participate if you would like to ask Dr. Bawardi any question by leaving a comment, or also if you would like to participate in the open mic portion, you can see the link at the scroll. So while you guys assemble your questions for Dr. Bawardi, I wanted to ask you about the Rabit al-Qalamiyya or the pen bond, and the fact that it was in New York on that little, I believe, Washington Street, and it had such a huge influence in its time. So in Mujaz, how do you think this pen bond impacted the Arab-American experience at that time, and how does it continue to impact it, or do you think it continues even in the first place to impact? And are there any traces of it left in the Arab-American culture here?
Well, let me start with the last part first. I mean, preserving that, their effect or their traces in our identity is really up to us. We just have to keep them alive somehow. How did they influence our identity? They provided the bedrock for this identity, which is reforms, belonging to a geographical area in the modern context of the world, meaning a place that we can claim our own, we can unfold on our own terms, self-rule, self-determination. They stood for all these things. So now let's talk about Arab Americans. So identity by definition, you identify yourself in relation to the other, right? So what made us Arab Americans is that we had a yearning for the same things, against odds, against first the Ottoman yoke, later on against colonialism by the French and the British. And those members of Rabat al-Qalamiyya sprung into action to raise aid during World War I, even before the end of World War I was even known, or how, which way it's going to go. they raised massive amounts of aid to help massive widespread starvation in Syria, in all parts of Syria, because of the blockade the Allies struck against the Turks. So our people began to die of hunger. Some 30% of the entire population perished. So they sprung into action. When the Balfour Declaration became known, they too wrote about that, as did Elia Abu Mahdi expressly about the... And it wasn't just the people we mentioned here. It was like a network of their friends and allies and churches and mosques and all kinds of like countrymen across the board lined behind them and followed their example. They were no leaders of like political movement per se, but they provided the inspiration for many of those actions or early formal political organizations that sought the freedom for Syria. One of those was the Free Syria Society. In fact, one of its members was Mikhail Naimi and Nasib Arida, two of their members.
Right. Thank you for that answer. So we have a question, and it says, were the pen bond involved in the first Arab Congress in Paris in 1913?
I'm really like trying hard to establish or document whether Amina Rihani attended the first Arab conference in Paris. But I can tell you definitively almost that Nasib Arida, who received his education in Nazareth, by the way, who was a friend of a fellow named Amin Farah in Flint, Michigan, the founder of the Free Syria Society, were exposed to the ideas of Al-Arabi Fatat, or the Young Arab Society, an anti-Ottoman secret society active in Montpellier and Paris, with members all over the place. It was so secret and so effective that to this day, we don't know all their members, by the way. Many of them perished. The only person who gave us an idea about that is George Antonios in a book, and I'm glad this came to mind. It's called Yaqdat al-Arab in Arabic, or Arab Awakening. It was published in English, in fact, in 1937. So they knew about the first Arab conference in Paris. Many of them actually thought that it expressed their innermost desires for some autonomy as a first step towards independence. And the rest, as you know, is a complicated matter we can discuss some other time.
Yes, of course. So we have another question from Nadia. What do you think Rihani and Gibran would tell us if they were alive in this challenging political moment today? That's a good question about this climate.
Yeah, there is the Arab Awakening by George Antonius. Thank you, Usam. I think it was Usam. Here is the thing. I think they will tell us the same thing. How do I put this? That's the question that kind of sent me in a loop in a way, because, you know, we all heard about the Arab Spring, for example, right? To my mind, as a historian, I think it is like picking up the slack where we left off after World War I. What they were telling us at the time is reform, unite, stay together, you're Arabs, free Syria, all of Syria, which is Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, and east of the Jordan River as one country. Yeah. So if they're alive today, they will say, hey, wake up again, so have another Nahda and you still have the same goals. So look at what's happening in Lebanon because of confessional politics, among other things. Look at what's happening in Syria. I mean, our dreams have been in suspension since their original message. So why would that message change? So I think they would say the same things.
Yeah. And she followed up by, you know, she wants to give the perspective. I believe you can read the screen. You know, the young people now are doing some work to reinvigorate the political responsibility of Arabs in the diaspora. So what is the way we engage our elders to actually get on the right path and really mobilize all these forces and political grassroots movements that are happening and sprouting a little bit here and there. Of course, with the most recent Lebanese experience in just past October.
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget that they were young people themselves once. Ali Abu Mahdi from the relative freedom of Alexandria. As a child, I had the distinct honor of meeting his son, Bob Mahdi, in the New York area. And he actually hand-gifted me this first diwan that Ali Abu Mahdi published in Alexandria. And aside from being a reformer and a feminist who wrote in favor of women, he was a nationalist. So, and a young person, and I think, depending on, we couldn't figure out exactly what his birth date was, but he was a child when he published this Diwan Ilya Dahar Abu Mahdi, the first part. Amir Rihani, Gibran, Naseeb Arida, as a young man, joined the Free Syria Society. We can follow their example. We can find the most progressive, the most inclusive organization. We have many of them. As long as they are independent and serve the larger or the greater good of Arab people. And to be honest with you, I mean, most of them turned their eyes to where the need was the greatest. So when colonialism led up around World War II, it yielded, you know, statelets like Syria and Lebanon and Transjordan, which became like Jordan of the eastern bank of the Jordan River, Egypt, distinct from, if you look at the map, you see like straight lines, thanks to Clemenceau and George Lloyd, you know, and Sykes-Picot, right. You know the story. We can challenge all of that and throw our weight behind whoever wants to unify this Arab world, beginning with the Levant, I would say. So again, where the need is the greatest, those countries became countries of their own, except for Palestine. That's a good place to start, I would say.
Right. Well, I just want to thank you once more, Dr. Bawardi, for your wealth of information. And of course, you are such a treasure to this community and to the University of Michigan community, of course. And I know you can talk about this for days and days and days. So,
thank you. I'm sure they agree with you.
Remind us again. Remind us again where to find your book and if you're working on something.
I'll show you. I don't mind plugging my book, actually, because I, you work very hard for those things. So you can find it straight from the publisher. It's on Amazon, but also the University of Texas Press. And the paperback should be around $20-$25. And if you have difficulty, get in touch. I mean, I'm easy to find. So.
Yes. Well, thank you once more, Dr. Bawardi. Thank you so much for this wonderful, wonderful talk.
Thank you.
Okay. So after this wonderful, informative talk by Dr. Bawardi, we will continue on with our programming. Next, we have Amal Baydoun, and most of us know her as a business consultant, human resources leader, and a development professional or event planner. But really, when she is not doing these daily life things, Amal is an avid reader and an aspiring storyteller who loves long walks, music, coffee, and food. And today she will be sharing with us some very special poetry, and I can't wait to hear it. Thank you so much for joining us, Amal.
Thank you, Zena. Good evening. So I will be reading three poems tonight, and these poems are dedicated to my sister Malak's memory. My sister died of cancer this past March. She was 36 years young. She was full of life, laughter, and songs, and she loved the color red, butterflies, birds, and music. The first poem is called Red Dress, and it has kind of a background story. My father died when Malak was 3 years old, and before she got sick, she would have this recurrent dream that she was 3 years old and our father was waiting for her in the distance and she was running towards him. So this poem is inspired by her dream. Red dress, I wonder sometimes if you and Dad are together now. I imagine that you are wearing a red dress, your hair beautiful and golden, your cheeks kissed by roses. Your giggles echo everywhere. I imagine Dad having a yellow shirt on. He picks you up in a blue car. Your favorite music is blasting, and the whole universe is singing your song. Excuse my bitterness, but I'm jealous. I am envious of your reunion. Part of me wants to be there, dancing in the sunshine with you, running towards eternity with you, finding a new home with you, seeking freedom from pain with you. I just want to be with you. But this life is seductive. It enchants me. It charms me. It calls me and pulls me by my feet, keeps me grounded here, just here, here. Here in this world where sunshines don't last, where mothers leave before dawn, where youth is not eternal, and where souls hunger for love, I'm grounded here until you call my name, until destiny carries my soul to you. Until then, on days when life is heavy, I will wait for you to visit me in a dream, singing and dancing in a red dress. I will smile, I will cry, I will wear red for you, listen to music for you, and I will envy your freedom, and I will crave your reunion. The second one is called When I Miss You. When I miss you, and I always do, I spin the world counterclockwise. I multiply the seconds by minutes, by hours, by days, by months, by years. I quantify eternity. When did time become so slow? When I miss you, never before and ever after collide, long-awaited milestones collapse at the feet of a cruel destiny. Stories escape my exhausted, unforgiven memory. When I miss you, I hide in the temple of your absence when all prayers become obsolete. When I miss you, I see all my voids flamboyantly bare. They taunt me. My sadness finally earns its own name. My fears take an identity and a shape. I find my questions, but I lose my path running to you. In the space between your existence and your absence, I make peace with my nostalgia for the complexity of the endless what ifs, for the simplicity of all that could have been, for the bitterness of everything that was lost. The last one, My New Lonely. In a city that calls my name, I face my lonely. I walked these streets before with you. We ran down the hills before they were luscious and green, when this land was a vast desert, before time, before this lifetime, way back at the dawn of everything. I remember this city. It remembers me too. It calls me. It calls the old playful soul that inhabited me. It calls a restless dream we shared, a dream I buried with you. I'm drawn to it. I try to come back from my lonely, but without you, my soul lives in solitude, and the only restlessness my mind knows is anxiety. In a city that calls my name, the way it did back when we were little, back when we still dreamed in color and we woke up excited to see the world, back when unicorns were a thing and angels danced in the rain, back when rainbows were made out of chalk, back when we whispered secrets before bedtime, back when we had 1,001 stories to share and when Shahrazad was our grandmother. The city remembers me. The city remembers you. The city calls me. The city calls you, but I'm stuck in my lonely. The hills are luscious. The rain is pouring. My tears are flowing. I miss you. I'm stuck in my lonely. My soul swirls in words, words unsaid, words unheard, unnecessary words, unwanted words, words of sadness, words of condolences, words of sorries, words of grief. Forget about the words. I don't want the words. I just want you here. You can't be gone. The city is calling our names. Our dream is calling. And without you, I'm lonely. Thank you.
Amal, that was, oh my God, that was absolutely beautiful. I'm a little speechless, honestly. I can't even begin to imagine the kind of pain that would, you know, that is in your heart. And I just wanted to know, have you been writing poetry all your life, or was it triggered by by this traumatic event. And again, thank you so much for sharing. This is really beautiful and really powerful and really wonderful. So I would love to hear about it a little bit more, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure. And no, I've been writing for most of my life. And I think writing is one way for me to process emotions, and writing is one way to kind of deal with it in a healthy way. And obviously with something like this, there's a lot of emotions. And knowing that my sister loved the beautiful things in the world, she loved the art, she loved things that are just pretty much, she was a beautiful soul. So I felt that the best way to honor her is write poetry. And some of it is sad, and some of it, honestly, sometimes when I write poetry to honor her, it can be silly and just funny and, you know, just the way she was.
Yeah. And on, you can definitely feel it. You can certainly feel. I love, you know, the shared experiences and those images that you drew on, and you know what you love to do together. That was really wonderful. And I know you're getting lots of messages and lots of love, and that was great. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself? I think this is the first time you share your poetry. Am I correct?
Yes.
So why have you waited so long, and what has inspired you to come on tonight?
Honestly, I don't know why I waited so long. So I'm a little bit protective over over my creative stuff. I actually, maybe it's kind of, life slows down a little bit in the middle of COVID and being home. And also it just kind of makes us feel that time is not always guaranteed in a way. And I think this whole experience of just being at home reminded me of the importance to connect and to share. And even if it's something that we're nervous or anxious or maybe not sure, or we want to hold on to and keep to ourselves, but this whole connectivity within this experience, kind of being alone but being together, it made a lot of sense to share.
Yeah, and I understand. I'm also very, very protective about, you know, the things that I create. But of course, when you're given such a stage like this, and in this environment, especially this, you know, extraordinary circumstances, I think it's really, it could be cathartic to kind of just let it out and heal others as you heal yourself.
Absolutely.
I honestly want to thank you once more. That poetry was wonderful. Again, guys, if you're watching and have any questions for any of our either lecturer or performers, please don't hesitate to hop on the chat. Or again, you can share your own poetry at the domain that is posted. Thank you again, Amal. I really, really appreciate you coming on today and sharing your beautiful, beautiful, wonderful poetry. Keep writing, and we will always keep listening and keep reading you. So thank you again. That was really, really special.
Thank you.
So our next performer is Samer Sarhan. And Samer is an educator by profession. He's an aspiring songwriter. He doesn't call himself a singer, and he's an also aspiring filmmaker by passion. Samer is an Arab American originating from Palestine and Lebanon, born and partly raised in Dearborn, and resided in Cyprus, Saudi, and Lebanon throughout his life. He is a husband and a father. He's also an observant Muslim, a gym fanatic, loves music and movies, and believes in the balance between the body, mind, and soul. And we're so lucky and so happy to have him on with us today. And I know we started right after iftar, so hopefully we gave you enough time to break your fast and then join us.
Yeah, I definitely needed to eat. You know, I needed some energy to do this. So yeah.
So thank you for joining, and take it away.
Thank you very much. So I'm live. Okay, good. So so my name is Samer. Living here in Canton. So the song that I wrote, it's called Pain. I wrote this about 20 years ago. I started writing it 20 years ago, and then I finished it about 10 years ago. You know, I made it my mission to go back to unfinished work that I had and just, you know, just get them done. The song was inspired by my love of rock and roll music. which I grew up listening to throughout the 80s and 90s. I was inspired mostly by, well, this band right here, Nirvana, Kurt Cobain, and also by this guy right over here, John Lennon from the Beatles. I come prepared, as you can see. So this song, I mean, today I want to dedicate it to quarantine people everywhere. Of course, everyone is at home right now dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, which is crazy time to be in right now. And I also want to give a shout out to my bandmate, I can call him, Joshua Cox. Joshua, I know you're watching this. Morinoka. But he couldn't make it, obviously, so I'm going solo today. And so this song I'm going to put out, as I said before, to the quarantine people everywhere. And also I want to make a little prayer to the people who are affected by the Midland flooding going on today, as well as people who have been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, as well as people everywhere who are suffering from, you know, war, famine, everything. I mean, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with everyone today. And before I forget, of course, Ramadan Mubarak and Eid Mubarak also is coming up in a couple of days. So, and thank you for my friends and family who are watching this. I appreciate you all for watching it. So let's get on with the show. The song is called Pain, as I said, followed by a little thing I did together with my partner, Josh, called Everything Will Be Okay at the End. Feel my pain, feel my sorrow, feel it again, maybe tomorrow. I need you forever, me and you together. You never should have left me in all this pain. You left me alone and I don't smile again. Hold my hand, stop me from crying. Hold it again, feels like I'm dying. I need you forever, me and you together. You never should have left me in all this pain. You left me alone and I won't smile again. Just how long will it be till the pain is leaving me? I can't take anymore. I wanna live in harmony. What more you want from me? Can't you let me be? Just set me free. Feel my pain, give me power, take it away, feel it every hour. You never should have left me in all this pain. You left me alone and I won't smile again. No, I won't smile again. No, I won't smile again. So much pain in the world, we should never forget that then after every storm comes the sunshine. Everything will be okay. Sing it out loud today. Everything will be okay. Sing it aloud today. And everything will be okay. Sing it aloud today. Everything will be okay. All together now from home. Sing it out loud to your day. And everything will be okay. One more time. Sing it out loud to your day. And everything will be okay. Take it away, Josh. Sing it aloud to you. Everything will be okay.
Thank you so much for that. That was awesome. Oh my
thank
gosh.
You, thank
and I
you,
love
thank
all the all the love and all the comments that you're getting. You have quite a fan base.
No way. I was not paying attention, honestly. So yeah, I'm flattered. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. That's really, really cool. So I'm also a fan of Kurt Cobain and Nirvana, of course, and it's just wonderful, wonderful music. But can you tell us a little bit about what drew you to them in the first place? What kind of, like, do you write similar songs, and do you what kind of, like, drew you to that genre in specific?
Just, I mean, rock music to me is more authentic than any other genre, just my perspective, my opinion. Of course, I grew up in an era where pop music was like the 80s, you know, the 80s, I'm sure, you know, Madonna, Michael Jackson, Prince. Yeah. We grew up in that era. And then switch over through the 90s, that's when grunge became a thing. And it just, you know, connected with me. You know, I mean, the music was about, you know, just raw emotion, which is something that, you know, had an impact on me personally. And I just became a big fan of that whole genre, just starting from then. Of course, it was a little bit of hip hop, but mostly it was more focused on, you know, rock and roll.
Right. Do you ever sing in Arabic?
No, I do not, unfortunately.
Will you start like Arabic rock or?
I might. Yeah. Yeah. I might.
That would be really fun.
Maybe if you can do that with me.
Yeah, exactly. So I know from your fan base, obviously you're out there. Do you have like your own YouTube channel? How do you get your music out there?
I mean, just through my personal Instagram. And I also do, like Sam just said in the comments below, I work at Star National Academy in Dearborn Heights. And throughout this year, basically I've done short films. Like I do skits and short films. So, I mean, I know that's not something that relates to my music, but, you know, again, I mean, I'm aspiring to do filmmaking as well as music, but Instagram is mostly where most of my stuff goes. I have a page for my short films. Again, not related to the music, but it's called Samsar Productions, Samsar_Productions. And you can also follow me on my Instagram, which is my name, S, first initial, last name, Sarhan. And you can find all my videos and stuff over there.
Awesome. Sam, if you can type that out so we could share it with everyone, that would be Wonderful. Again, if you guys want to jump in and ask Samer or any of the of our other performers any question, please feel free to post them in the chat. And also, if you'd like to participate in the open mic section at the end, also let us know by logging onto the link. Samer, do you have one more song for us in you?
No, I think I've wasted all my energy for today.
You're good.
Yeah. Save some for the next performer, Kareem. I'm sure he's fantastic. So
yes, everyone is so wonderful. Well, I want to thank you again for joining us, and that was really
thank you. Great. Thank you very much.
We loved it, and keep doing. And I mean, I know filmmaking, and I know Wissam said you're a great video clip maker and stuff. They're not music, but they're also art, and they're all, you know, forms of self-expression that are more needed than ever in these trying times. So keep doing what you're doing, because it's all so wonderful. And thank you again for joining us. We were
thank you very much, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, well, as Samer told you, the next performer that we have is Kareem Kanu. He's a Dearborn-based guitarist / musician. He is a civil engineer by day and Batman by night. Totally joking. And just like he strums the strings of a guitar, he will do the same to the heartstrings. So take it away, Kareem. True.
Hello. That was a pretty impressive introduction. I liked it, honestly. So my name is Kareem. I'm 29 years old. And as you mentioned, I am a full-time civil engineer and a part-time music performer. I would love to be a full-time music performer at one day. And I'll play two things for you guys. One of them is a classic mixed with something that I made up. And the second one would be a song. All right. I hope I'm not too loud since I'm using this microphone, but let me know if it's too loud in the comments. That's number one. I hope you guys liked it. It's called Romance d'Amour, mixed up with some chords that I made myself. And the second one is going to be a song. Probably I should put that out there. I don't sound as good as I play. All right. That's the most impressive thing you're going to get out of me, what I played. So, but I hope you guys like this this song. We'll make it a little bit romantic. How about that? Sounds good. All right. If you guessed the name of the song, type it in the comments. Let you be a hero. Judens, if I ask you to dance, would you run and never look back? Would you cry if you saw me crying? Would you save my soul tonight? I can be your hero, baby, and I can kiss away the pain, and I'll stand by you forever. Come on, you can take my breath away. Would you swear that you'll always be mine? Or would you lie? Would you run away? I mind too deep. I've lost my mind. Well, I don't care, we're here tonight. I can be your hero, baby, and I can kiss away the pain, and I'll stand by you forever. Come on, you can take my breath away. How about some high notes? I can be your hero, baby, and I can kiss away the pain. Ooh. And I'll stand by you forever. Come on. You can't take my breath away. I can be your little hero. Right, that's it from me.
Wow! Oh my God!
Thank you. Damn. I appreciate you, Zaina. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that beautiful music. You are amazing on the guitar.
Thank you so much.
And people are guessing the song "Hero."
Yep. That's sister. It doesn't count. That's cheating. I'm just saying. Gotta put that out there.
That was really good.
Thank you so much. Yeah. She knows. Well, we live together, so she kind of knows what I play, you know? She recognizes everything that I know.
Maybe she can hop on next time.
Well, she doesn't really sing or play. She just knows what I sing and play. You know what I mean? That's why she typed hero, because she knew it.
Well, that was really, really good.
Thank you. And I want to thank you guys for organizing this, especially through these hard times and having variety of shows and also having me. That was fun, you know, it's type of change. And you know, meeting and probably playing for more people. So it's nice to share music. And so I appreciate you guys doing all this work. I know it's not easy to gather people and do the advertising and this, so. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much for joining us. And of course, nothing can replace physical presence. Of course, the music like reaches further and further and is so beautiful and more immersive. But that was really, really wonderful. So tell us a little bit more about yourself. For those of you of us who don't know you, tell us a little bit more about your life and what brought you to music and what inspires you.
All right, let me remember the questions right now. So, like I said, Kareem, I'm 29 years old. So we moved to the U.S. Okay, let's go back a little bit. I grew up in UAE, United Arab Emirates, and I stayed there for 14 years. Then we moved to Syria, and we stayed for 8 years. And because of the war, and we had that immigration case that was going on, we just used it. We immigrated to the U.S. in 2014. So it's been about 6 years for me since I moved to the U.S. And you can tell that my English is getting better. You know what I mean? It was even worse than this back in the days. I graduated as a civil engineer, but I wanted to follow my dream, which was, you can see I have music tattoos all over because I'm like so into music and stuff. So I'm trying to make it big, you know, at least maybe within Dearborn now. I do have students. I want to say I still have them because we just stopped because of all of this, but we're hoping everything, inshallah, is going to go back to normal one day. So I also perform at weddings, birthdays, graduations, and whatnot. And I had 5 bookings so far that have been postponed because of what's going on right now. So, and one more question that you had for me, I'm going to answer that. When did I start or what got me into music? It was my dad when I was 4. He used to play a little bit trumpet, a little bit keyboard, a little bit guitar, not much, you know what I mean? But when I was a kid, I look at him, and when he's playing something, especially on the guitar, he would do this move, I still remember, which is pretty basic, you know what I mean? But as a kid, I look at him, I'd be like, wow, dad, amazing. I want to get into that, you know what I mean? So my dad, he started kind of showing me how to play. Then I grew up actually just self-taught, then YouTube came. So I started with a piano, that was my first instrument, and it's my main instrument since I was 4, and I started doing guitar. When my dad visited the U.S. in year 2000, I was in UAE, but he was visiting his brother, and he came with a new guitar, classic one, and he got an electric one. So this is when I more got into it. I was like, this is getting out of hand. You know, I was so into this music. And he got us a cassette from the U.S. back in the days. You remember these tape ones that they have to put in there? You know? So he got us one that has that song Hotel California. And ooh, in the back, it's always
the Eagles.
You know what I mean? So I was listening to this instrument. I was like, oh my God, I love American music. You know what I mean? So this is what got me into music. This is what got me into the guitar. This is what got me into the piano. And I think I got all your questions, unless I missed something.
That's wonderful. I love that. And I love that your father inspired you to get into that. That's so
I can't hear you. Oh, I don't know if you still can hear me, but I can't hear you.
Am I cutting out? Am I good? Can you hear
me? Yeah, we can hear you, Zaina. It's probably Kareem.
Okay.
Can you hear me, Kareem?
I can't hear neither of you for some reason.
Okay, we'll bring everyone in. Go ahead, Zaina, continue.
Sounds good. Well, I want to thank everyone who participated again in this Dearborn open mic. And I really, really want to thank Wissam for putting all of this together and putting up with us as well. Honestly, he's I don't know how he does it. I sometimes call him an octopus because I think he has more hands than the regular human. So thank you so much, Wissam. Without you, honestly, we wouldn't be able to bring such amazing programming and providing a wonderful venue for people to share their art and entertain us. And it was a wonderful, wonderful evening. Anyone else would like to share anything, feel free.
No, thank you all for participating. Encourage your friends. This is the platform where we want to show all the talents in the community. A lot of people hesitate about believing in themselves, and when they come out, this proves to them that you know, there are always fans of the work. So don't hold on to your art. We need to share it.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with you, Sam. If you have a passion for something, just go out there and do it. No matter how many people trying to put you down, you know, discourage you, put doubt in you, put that all aside, just go for it, do it. I, you know, really commend everybody here for stepping up to the plate.
And thank you, Dr. Bawardi, for the very valuable lecture.
My pleasure. And Dearborn is an important way station in the Arab American saga. We have one in New York, of course, and I'm wearing a couple of hats, and we're hoping to replicate this from the New York area. Maybe we can sort of repeat that all over the country until we have a real network, you know, of Arab American artists, authors, poets, musicians. Inshallah, yeah.
Great. Final words, Zaina.
Zaina, great job. I know I'm singing is not the easiest thing to do, yes, but you're just phenomenal. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the kind words. But thank you all, Mal, Samer, Karim, Dr. Bawardi. You guys, honestly, at Haftuna, it was wonderful.
Thank you all.
And Wissam, let's not also forget to share Karim's information with people who would like to find his work.
Yeah, I did post his YouTube and Instagram channels.
Where to find everything. We are cutting out.
Sorry, yeah, I shared Karim's YouTube and Instagram on the...
I can hear you now, guys. I'm back.
Awesome. Welcome back.
Sorry that I missed. I don't know what you guys were saying.
Even on the YouTube feed.
Yep. I'm on Instagram and Facebook and YouTube. I think that's what Wissam just said.
All right, just reminding everyone that Dearborn Open Mic is the third Wednesday of each month. And the one in Arabic, Al-Muntada Al-Thaqafi fi Dearborn, is the first Wednesday of each month. Our next official meeting is on June 3rd. And actually, I'll be giving a talk about the history of Arabic flags. So tune in to that, and we're going to have special guests. It's going to be focused on the Nakba, on commemorating Palestine. So we're going to have some poetry and music related to that. We also have two special events coming up. Just stay tuned on the Arab American Center for Culture and Arts page. Also, we post everything on Dearborn blog, and you'll get more information. Thank you, guys. Have a great night.
Good night.
Thank you.
Peace out. Bye-bye.